right across the Charles River, there's another Bostonian doing his city proud, Yo-Yo Ma, the virtuoso cellist, Grammy Award winner, and extremely nice guy. He has gotten a lot of attention over the last decade for leading the Silk Road Ensemble, which is a group that draws its members and music from countries all across Asia. Spending so much time on the road, Yo-Yo Ma gets really close to his travel companion.
This is nicknamed Petunia.
Yeah.
It's
so you're like B.B. King. You name your instruments.
Yeah, Lucille and Petunia. Maybe they'll meet one day, you know, because I love B.B. King. So Petunia was named by a high school student. Her name's Brittany, and she asked, "Do you have a name for your cello?" I said, "I don't. But if you think of a good name, maybe I'll use it." And Petunia sounded pretty good.
Tell me more about this instrument. Is it really, really old and really, really fine?
It is 1733, and it was made in the city of Venice. And I love it because it has a really rich, deep voice. And it growls when you need it to and sings and soars when you'd like it to do otherwise.
Is it the one you left in a taxi cab?
That'd be the one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Has she forgiven you?
Yes. She wouldn't talk to me for a couple of days, but then after that, we're now good buddies.
Now, when you wake up in the morning and you sit down to practice, as I assume you do, what do you first do? What do you first play?
Well, I do something like... I've become friends with the instrument.
Uh-huh.
I try not to tax it too much. It's really like warming up a car or warming up your body.
Uh-huh.
You stretch it.
Uh-huh.
You don't go into a fast run. You don't take it to 60 in 3 seconds or whatever. Because what's funny about an instrument made out of wood, every day the humidity is different.
Mm-hmm.
Every day the temperature is different, and wood, as well as our bodies, are slightly different. So I think it's actually making that relationship happen.
Mm-hmm. And once you do get it warmed up, what are you inclined to play?
I might play some Bach, which is something that I started learning as soon as I started playing, and it's also something that's written for cello alone. This is music that is somewhat meditative. And
show,
I'll just play.
Show, don't
I
tell.
Will play. Here, this is show and tell.
I'll be back in a minute with Yo-Yo Ma in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is the first Bach cello suite. Yo-Yo Ma plays this piece, as he is now, every single day. But it's not just to warm up his fingers. For him, it's sort of like meditation.
I think of the flow of water,
mm-hmm.
of, you know, the light, afternoon light playing in the on leaves, so that you see something that is familiar and yet it's different every day.
Is it really? I mean, you must have played that piece of music hundreds and hundreds of times.
Yeah,
thousands, maybe.
But what's amazing is that, you know, I could, with a great friend, you could see them thousands of times and you don't look at them and say, "Well, today I'm really bored with you."
Sometimes.
But I learned it playing this way. As a four-year-old. And, you know, until sometime around I was a teenager, I thought, you know, I look at the score and it's written different bowing, so I tried that. And then at some point I was asked by the head of the Schweitzer Institute. He wanted me to talk about Bach. And so suddenly, having to verbalize music that I had known forever took me to another way of thinking about sort of, well, Bach, Schweitzer described, was a pictorial composer. And then I thought about, well, what does that mean? So one of the things that he coded was infinite variety. Instead of the materiality of saying, this is the same thing, I need a new product, it's something new every time.
Do you think that's a common feeling among musicians playing a repertoire, or is the fact that the cello repertoire is so relatively limited force you to find the endless variety in what you have to play?
Well, I think I would probably answer it more in terms of when our children would say, I'm bored. It's you're laughing, you're smiling because you've heard the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, things aren't boring, but people can be boring. I think there's so much to explore in cello repertoire, but I think what's more interesting to me is how people do music differently, because my big passion is actually people.
Yeah, and I've talked to people who've worked with you, and they say that you have an uncommon lust for collaboration.
Lust. I like that. I like that.
And the Silk Road project, obviously, is an example of that. This record you put out not long ago, Appalachia Waltz, with a fiddler. The wonderful tango music by Piazzolla. Oscar Piazzolla.
Yeah, that's such great music. I'm interested in figuring out when do we get great films coming out of certain places? When do we get great novels coming out? And why does that happen? Why does music come out of certain areas? Astor Piazzolla is a great example. He was someone who was a hybrid, taken to Manhattan when he was very young, listened to jazz, went to Paris, studied with Nadia Boulanger, lived in Uruguay. And it's all of those influences that created the new tango, for which he was kicked out of his own taxi cab because the cab driver thought he was toying with a sacred tradition, which was at that time not yet 100 years old.
I expect your children must have been astounded when their father many times, I believe, appeared on Sesame Street. Let's listen to a little bit of Yo-Yo Ma on Sesame Street.
Mr. Ma, want to play with Elmo?
Let's do it.
Okay.
He was practicing the violin and he got stuck on a scale, and I helped him through that note. And I feel that I have played a small part in Elmo's musical development.
Really?
Before he became Elmo the superstar.
So as Casals and Rostropovich are to you, you are to Elmo, I guess.
I think so. This is, he's never acknowledged that publicly, but
is there
happy.
Is there a feud here?
No, there's no feud there. No. I am just extremely proud of what he's contributed.
Now, when you were a little kid in the pre-Sesame Street age, at 7 you played for President Kennedy, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. At 16 you gave a recital at Carnegie Hall, and you got your first review in the New York Times, a rave.
It's probably my last rave review from the New York Times.
What was your offstage, non-performative life as a little kid and an adolescent like?
Well, I came from a very protective family. So I was kind of didn't go out much, didn't socialize a lot. And I think that was both a boon in terms of, you know, being very focused, very little television, whatever. So I had to sneak a transistor radio in the house so I could listen to what else was going on. And in my teenage years, I really was bursting to try and kind of get out and to figure out what the world was like. And what college gave me was to really appreciate there are many ways of exploring the world, and there are many people who are at least as passionate about what they were interested in as I may have been in music.
And that was new to you as a notion?
Absolutely. You know, people doing computer science, Fortran at that time, and sociobiology was coming into play, molecular biology, and it was mind-boggling to think about what people were exploring.
And out of those habits of mind from your rich liberal education, it seems to me, it's natural that you started on your Silk Road project, which, for our listeners who don't know, looks at all of the musical trends from China through Southeast Asia and the Near East. What led you to this idea, which you've been doing now for 10 years? Was it a way to challenge yourself musically?
I think the more I look at something that I know well, such as the classical music tradition, the more I realize that that tradition was born out of many other traditions. So specifically, going to the Imperial Museum, the Shosoin collection in Nara, Japan, which is the early capital, and where Buddhism first arrived.
Near Kyoto.
Near Kyoto. Thank you. And you see instruments. There was one instrument in particular, a pipa, a biwa, which is a strummed instrument, pear-shaped, and it had a painting in leather of a Chinese landscape of a Persian man and an elephant. And then in the back are sort of like mother-of-pearl inlays and two beautiful red stones. And those stones only come from East Africa.
Wow.
And
there it is.
There it is. And it says, okay, from 800, here's some evidence of, you know, people really taking in what was all around and making it their own.
Globalization 1.0, I guess.
Exactly. That's right.
There must be particular tunes that you're playing where it's hard to play on your 18th century Venetian cello music that is Eastern. Is that translation hard, just technically?
Well, I'll give you an example of something. So many people, many of our listeners know what the piano sounds like, and there's piano intonation. I think one of the things that is different are actually the intervals. So let's say you have a scale that goes, starts with D and then. Now, we hear. But this is one. That's what it would sound like on the piano, the all located notes. Now, there's a mode in Persian music that's if you play. You play this note a little sharper. Now, to play this music, just play it out of tune. Now, the fact that I'm saying out of tune implies that you're coming from a certain place. But if I say, let's take this reality, that this is really beautiful. And if you step across and say, I welcome this as something beautiful. And so if you play this there and you say, this is extraordinary and it is revelatory because it really takes you not only into a beautiful place inside, it actually takes you possibly in this piece to the color blue in the city of Naishapur, ancient city of Naishapur in ancient Persia. Suddenly, what does the imagination conjure up?
It seems like a great illustrative metaphor for the way maybe we should begin to think about talking to people in Persia about larger, facts of life. Those points of view are fundamental and often so disparate.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right, because I think one of the things that we learned, and this is a political truth. We went last year to Azerbaijan, to Baku, which is a city that Rostropovich was born in. So here's like, you know, one of my great idols born in the capital of Azerbaijan, which is the second country to the right of Turkey. So Azerbaijan was part of Persia in the 1800s. But in a war with Russia, where Persia lost, Azerbaijan was given to Russia. And there are apparently millions and millions of Azeris that live in Iran today. Didn't know that. We think of Iran as a country, but actually its history is easily over 5,000 years old. I think to have a conversation, it helps to know that.
Do you think that kind of, the kind of fusion music you're doing, sort of saying that the classical repertoire is not limited to what was composed by Europeans 150 years ago, is part of the process of making sure there'll be audiences in 50 years from now?
Well, I think any tradition that doesn't continually evolve will eventually become smaller. And I feel I'm a better musician playing Bach today.
Really?
After having done 8-9 years of the Silk Road Project, because I just feel so much more liberated in just feeling as a human being, first of all. Secondly, instead of feeling like, oh, gee, I am enslaved to the printed note, I realize there are probably, you know, 29 more ways of doing anything. And that if we're exploring all the different ways that music has ever been made and we participate in it, that gives us so much more choice than saying, oh, I'm a performer, I'm a recreative person, you're a creative artist, and you write the stuff, and I don't want to know what you're drawing from. But if we know all of this stuff, it actually makes for one of the preconditions for greater creativity.
Has there been one surprise discovery about these musical traditions of which you were presumably not entirely fluent when you began that sticks with you? Like, geez, I just had no idea that in Azerbaijan they have this thing, or in Pakistan they do X.
Oh, I think there is like constant surprises. You know, one of my favorite stories is Sandeep Das, who's from Delhi and comes in for rehearsal in New York for a Persian piece that Kayhan Kalhor, the great Kemanche player from Iran, has written. And he literally steps off the plane at Kennedy, arrives, you know, cheerful, charming, ready to go. We play through this 23-minute piece, and he says, can we do it again? And we look at our watch and says, you know, we have a two-hour rehearsal, and this time is short. Why don't we start from measure 161? And he says, well, I wish I could, but I don't read music. But if you do it once more, I will know the whole piece by heart. That's a different way of learning.
Yo-Yo Ma, thank you very much for coming into Studio 360 today and bringing Petunia.
Thank you, Kurt. It's wonderful to be on your show.